This Week in Free Energy.
Imagine a world in which each home has its own power generator that obtains its energy in such a way that no fuel has to be added. Imagine every vehicle being able to run without ever stopping for fuel. Imagine each appliance having its own power source that never has to be recharged. That is the world of the future. Join with us now as we track our progress towards such a world.
Welcome to Free Energy Now. This is Sterling Allen, your host. You can join us online at freeenergynow.net to see the past speakers and future lineup that we have. Today, our guest is Larry Neal from the Butterfly LLC. He's going to be talking to us about a flying motorcycle that is available for sale now. If you have a motorcycle license and a pilot's license, you can get in one of these things and drive her around for about US $37,000. Not bad. Welcome to the show, Larry.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
A flying motorcycle. Now, who would have ever thought? Now, obviously, we're not quite ready to be able to jump in one of these things, get stuck in traffic, turn on the props, and away you go. Not quite there. You have to come and go from an airport, correct?
No, that's not correct. What we do is never get in that traffic jam to start with. You purposely stay off the highways all you can. Any little field to do. You don't have to have a runway.
Just go off into the dirt and fly away?
Yeah, just any little field the size of a football field or in that range is fine. The aircraft leaves the ground in about 3 to 5 seconds from the time you release the brakes, and you can come in and sit down with no roll at all. So we've eliminated runways and airports.
Now, something I saw said you need about 20 feet to land. What's that about?
Well, that's with your rotor. Your rotor is actually 26 feet long, and you got to have an area big enough that you don't hit your rotor on anything.
Right. Now, in terms of regulations, what kind of stipulations does the FAA give you about where you can land and take off?
You can land this aircraft anywhere you can take off and land a helicopter or any other type of aircraft. It is a real N-numbered aircraft. You just have restrictions like flying over cities. You need to be at least 500 to 1,000 feet high. And if you fly over open ground, you can be 5 feet high. It's totally up to you.
Okay. So the learning, in terms of the licensing to be able to fly one of these things, I would think you'd need more like a helicopter-type license than a pilot license for, say, a small plane.
Well, since it's an experimental aircraft is the way it's home-built, the person buys the kit and builds it himself, and since it's a 51% rule experimental aircraft, and it's only a single-seater, the regular pilot's license is still legal to fly it because you're not hauling a passenger. You also don't have to have that rotorcraft rating because you're not hauling a passenger. So the typical person that's never flown anything, after about 6 to 10 hours of dual instruction in a two-place, will be signed off to solo his own vehicle and will be legal to fly on a student pilot's license.
What's the range of this thing?
It can go up to 300 miles, just depending on how much of the reserve fuel tanks you want to add to it.
And what kind of safety are we talking about?
It's probably the safest aircraft that's ever been built. It's a real simple type aircraft. It's no complexity like a helicopter at all. It's just a rotating rotor on top that's with a fixed pitch blade, so there's no collective. And it's a pusher propeller like an airboat. The propeller in the back pushes you forward, and the rotating wing makes it fly. So you fly the rotor.
So rather than having wings that require speed to make you airborne, you have the propeller that makes you airborne, and then the rear propellers, like, let's say, a what do they call those? The name's escaping me. It just slipped my tongue.
That's what gives you your thrust to make it fly.
It's like a paraglider. So the motorcycle aspect, this is a three-wheel vehicle, correct?
Yes, it is.
One in front, two in back, or the other way around?
Yes, yeah, I guess it's one in front, two in the back. It's a trike.
And how fast can the trike version of it go, the road-ready version?
55 miles an hour.
Okay, so this is not necessarily a freeway drivable machine, because
there again, it's designed to never have to get on that freeway. Where we're heading with this is to help people get in the air and off of the congested roads.
So its basically the primary function is to fly. Secondary function is to drive, and the drivability enables you to get to where you need to go where you can't fly.
You are exactly right.
Okay.
The ratio is 90-10. You fly it 90% of the time, you drive it to the last 10%. That's what it's designed to do.
Now, of course, our emphasis is in energy, and this is a bit of a tangent to energy efficiency, but the applicability, as you and I mentioned to me in an earlier conversation, is the savings on time, and time is money, so it's more of a convenience at this point, not necessarily an energy conservation scenario, but when we talk about being able to go from point A to point B as the bird flies, so to speak, there are going to be savings on distance. Is that going to compute to a savings in fuel when you take into consideration that you don't have to drive a zigzag type of route? You can go a straight route, or is this not necessarily an energy conservation scenario at all?
Well, if you look at the average car on the road, probably the average mile per gallon of most cars is about 25 miles to the gallon that you actually burn going somewhere. And the fact that we get 20 miles to the gallon in flight, and we maybe can cut the distance even up to half, then actually it would be cheaper, even gas mileage, for the trip to fly.
So it'd be the equivalent of a 40 mile per gallon vehicle.
That's exactly right.
When you take into consideration the distance saved and the mile per gallon consumed.
This is true.
And that's, of course, averaging out wind speeds and things like that.
Yes.
How high can you fly?
It'll fly about 12,000 feet.
12,000 feet. Give us an idea for those of us who are not conversant with elevations. How high does the average, let's say, a prop engine, a Cessna, for example, fly as
Most
opposed to...
Most little Cessnas fly 3,000 to 5,000 feet. Is there a normal flying?
3,000 to 5,000?
Yes.
And when you say 3,000 to 5,000 feet, that's above ground or above sea level?
That's above the ground.
Okay. So if you were flying one of these things in Colorado, which is a mile high, for example, Denver is considered the mile high city, and you were then 12,000 feet above that, would you be able to fly higher above, let's say, San Diego, which is sea level?
We actually have another engine available that's turbocharged, and that engine has the capability to go about 28,000 feet. So, depending on where you live, would be our recommendation whether you needed a turbocharged engine or not. The only thing is, you can only go above 12,500 feet for 30 minutes before you need oxygen legally.
Uh-huh.
So, most people will fly, I think, in these vehicles between 1,000 and 3,000 feet will be our normal altitude.
Uh-huh.
We'll be below the little fixed wings, and we're just high enough that we've got plenty of places to land if we need to. And it's a lot prettier closer to. You can see a lot more.
Mm-hmm. It's equipped with all the typical gauges in terms of the, of course, the tachometer, but things like the altitude and all that kind of, the pitch, those, what kind of gauges do you have on this thing?
Well, believe it or not, we probably have a more sophisticated little gauge package than even the 747s in the sky right today. We have what you call the highway in the sky system, which is a little $3,000 unit that just come on the market. It's got every engine function, of course. It's got airspeed, altitude. It's got the compass. It has a full-blown GPS, but it also has a little button. When you flip the button, it goes to the highway in the sky system, which is a virtual world just like a computer game. And it's got real-time data using GPS where you're at, And if you're, you could be flying in the middle of the night and still see the lakes, the towers, and the trees on the little screen, just like TV. And it has the capability to build your highways in there called the highway in the sky, and it puts little squares in the little highway that you want to fly through. And we have a little trim system. You flip a lever, and the little trim will fly you through the little squares automatically. So it's a real sophisticated little ship, even from the go.
Are you saying it's an autopilot function?
Yeah, it's such a stable ship, we don't have to have a true autopilot as such that costs $15,000 to $20,000. It's a little trim system. It just adds a little trim to the rudder, and a little trim to the stick is needed to make it fly left or right or up and down. So it's a real simple little autopilot, yes, but it just does it with trim. So it hooks right into the GPS highway in the sky system.
So
we have the capability to fly a very precise course every day to work and back.
Mm-hmm. You just turn on the trim system and take a nap and have alarm clock wake you up?
Literally, we're working on a fully enclosed body for this model, too. It's called a super sky cycle right now, but once the body goes on, it's just a bolt-on body. We'll call it the commuter.
The which?
And it will be made for people if they travel 50 to 75 miles to work and back. They literally could zip down to their work and back 120 mile an hour in their own little personal fly drive vehicle. And let's say your workplace has a field next to it, and they say, sure, you can land and take off there. We'll call that a TOLA, a takeoff and landing area. You could literally land in the field by your work, fold a rotor blade up, and put it in your parking spot. When you get ready to go home, you go out to the field. You bring the rotors to full flying speed. When you release the brakes, you're in the air in 3 to 5 seconds. You zip home, you land, you put it in the garage. That's where we're headed.
How long does it take to put up the blades and take them down?
It takes about 3 minutes.
And is it something a woman could do, a woman who's not that strong?
Yes, that's exactly right. Everything is kind of balanced out with itself. We have a little spring-loaded pin. You just push up on this button, and you just fold the rotor blade around, and it sits in a little holder that flips out, and you put a little bungee over the top to hold it in place. You get a hold of the rotor blade, you push the little spring-loaded deal up, you fold the rotor around, and you're going to be lifting about 10 pounds of rotor, so it's nothing. And you've just folded the rotor doing what I just said. So it's a very simple thing to do.
The diameter of the rotors you said earlier is 26 feet, so
yes.
There's about 13 feet of radius that you're having to put into what kind of configuration? Does it point out ahead of the, or does it go, I mean, what's the orientation?
What's unique about this system, and it's patent pending, I call it the folding link rotor. It has a double link joint where the hub bar hooks onto the rotor blade, and the hub bar itself is 7 feet long. So the rotor folded out is 26 feet, but it folds down to 12 foot four long, fore and aft. So it's not even, doesn't even stick past the front or the rear of the vehicle.
So folded is 12 foot four, which is shorter than the actual frame of the
The aircraft itself is 14 foot four, so it's quite a bit shorter even than the vehicle.
Okay. And how big is your fuel tank?
We have a 7.4 is standard. Then we have a 6-gallon reserve. We have an 8.3-gallon reserve. And then we have 2 5-gallon reserves. So you can have up to 25.7 gallons of fuel if you want to put those reserves on there.
And what would your range be at 25.7 gallons?
Really about 350 miles.
And without the reserves?
It flies at about a little less than 5 gallons an hour, so you'd have 120 miles just on the one little tank.
Uh-huh. And what kind of fuel does it take?
It takes car gas at the pump.
Okay, so when you're driving this thing around as a vehicle, like a motorcycle/tricycle, you just pull into a regular gas station. What kind of height are you talking about?
It squats down to under 7 feet tall to go in the garage, or just standing there ready to fly and drive, it's 7'4".
And will 7'4" go in the garage?
No. It's got to be a little under 7 feet to go in a normal garage. So you just pull it up to the garage, you touch a button, it lets air out of the shocks, and it squats down to within 1 inch of the floor, and you can drive it in the garage. It's under 7 feet.
Okay. It'll fit in a regular car slot at 14 feet?
Yes.
So the typical garage of a home could accommodate this thing without any special engineering of the garage?
That is exactly true. We knew it had to fit in the standard American garage if we were going to call it a motorcycle. Uh-huh. We can't have to have a hangar to put it in when you can put it in the garage at the house.
How many have you sold?
I've sold 5 of that model.
How many of other models?
I've sold a total of 34.
How many models do you have?
I actually have 4 models now.
And what are those?
There's the Emperor is the smallest gyroplane that we sell. It's a little 50 horsepower, just a gyroplane. It does fit in the back of a standard size pickup truck, so you can haul your little flying machine around in your truck with you. The second model is the Monarch, which has 66 horsepower.
Let's stop on the Emperor for a second. Is the Emperor a fly-in drive?
No, the Emperor is just the simplest little gyroplane you probably could ever have. It's made just to fly. It's not made to drive on the road at all. And it has a 59-inch landing gear wide, and it fits in the standard size pickup. And I actually, on the Kitty Hawk 2003 celebration at Kitty Hawk, North Carolina, I actually took a Monarch with that landing gear on there in the back of my pickup and got to fly around the monument 3 times on the anniversary date of the Wright Brothers.
How fun.
It was neat.
Okay, that's the Emperor. What's another model?
The Monarch is the same frame. It's just got a bigger motor. It's got a water-cooled motor. It's got 66 horsepower. And it's got the optional different landing gears, which we call the G-Force landing gear, which has a parallelogram set up with a long stroke. And we've actually tested that landing gear from flaring the height of a light pole and auto-rotating down to the ground without hurting anything.
Hmm. So it's like a helicopter, except it also does not have the drive option.
That's right.
Okay, what's your next model?
The next model is the two-place, which is called the Golden Butterfly. It's a big two-place trainer that actually stands 11 feet tall. It's 17 foot 5 long, and it's about 7 foot 6 wide. It is designed to train people how to fly the other machines. That's its purpose in life.
When people purchase one of these, then do you have a training required, or is that optional?
The FAA requires the training. They've got all that worked out in the system with the FAA. And like I say, to get your student pilot's license, you would need to get a aircraft medical, and you would get dual instruction with a CFI, a certificated flight instructor. And after about 6 to 10 hours of dual in his two-place, he will sign your medical, and that becomes your student pilot's license. That's good for 90 days at a time. Once he signs you off to solo, you legally can fly your sky cycle and be building time toward your license.
Okay, we'll come back to that. And then the fourth model is the Super Sky Cycle, which is the one we've been talking about.
This is true. The Super Sky Cycle has a 100 horsepower aircraft engine, 4-stroke, 4-cylinder. It's you've heard talk about the new light sport aircraft that the FAA has just instituted?
No, I'm not familiar with that.
Okay, the FAA has just allowed a new type of aircraft called a sport plane. And we're putting that sport plane engine, that's the most popular engine in the new light sport aircraft industry, that's what we put in the Sky Cycle. It's got a proven track record of being dependable, fuel efficient, and quiet. So we chose that engine. Specifically, it's a $17,000 engine that we put on the Sky Cycle, but we did it for safety, for longevity, and for fuel economy.
Mm-hmm. And that engine is made by who?
It's made by Rotax in Austria.
And how long have you been selling the Super Sky Cycle?
I put it on the market 1 year ago.
Okay. And so let's talk now. Let's go back to the previous point where you're talking about the two-place golden butterfly, which is your training model. Let's say today I wanted to buy one of these things. I don't have a motorcycle license, and I don't have a pilot's license. I have no experience flying. I've ridden a motorcycle for entertainment purposes as a teenager, but that was a long time ago. How long and what steps am I going to have to go through to get to the point where I can buy one of these things and fly it to destinations?
Okay, the first thing you'd want to do is find the closest CFI and gyroplanes to you and start taking lessons. And he'll know after about 6 to 10 hours is the average if you've never flown anything. He'll say, okay, you can fly this two-place really good. I'm going to go ahead and sign you off to solo. At that point, you can start transitioning into your sky cycle. You'll just step out of the two-place and go in the single-place and then start taxiing, learn how to taxi. You'll learn how to balance on the mains. You'll learn how to what we call crow hop. You simply will lift off the ground a few feet and fly a few feet over the ground and then set back down. And then you'll do that longer and longer until you're flying the full length of the runway. In other words, you work into your single-place, getting familiar with it, because you've already had the two-place instruction. You know what to do. You've been taught. And then before long, you'll be making around the pattern. We call it around the pattern. You'll take off and fly a complete circle and come in and land. And you'll be building time from that point on and logging it in your logbook toward your real pilot's license. But you're legal to solo at that time and fly. As far as the motorcycle part, it's real simple. It's like an automatic transmission. You just give it a little gas, and it takes off just like a little scooter. And the more gas you give it, the faster it goes, and it's got brakes on the handlebars. So it's real easy to drive. So you just get out, maybe even drive it around the airport in the drive mode until you learn how to do that. Of course, you'd have to pass the motorcycle test at the Department of Motor Vehicles. And once they give you your motorcycle license, emblem on your regular driver's license, then you're legal to go there too.
Okay, on the motorcycle license, typically how much time would be involved? I mean, let's say you're an average, for argument's sake, a guy who is able to drive, drive a motorcycle. Maybe you've driven one before and it comes pretty naturally. Motorcycle license takes how many hours to get?
I would say after 4 or 5 hours of driving this thing around the airport. As far as I understand, all you've got to do is you could haul your sky cycle to the DMV, mm-hmm. and you've got to pass the written test. Then they just stand there and watch you. They just want to watch you drive your motorcycle down there and turn around and come back. That's all they want to make sure you can ride it. Because this thing is a trike, you don't have to worry about it falling over, so it's really easy to drive. It's really stable. And, once you haul your motorcycle there and you've passed your written and he sees you drive it down the road and back, then they'll sign you off right immediately.
You can get the motorcycle license using a regular motorcycle, of course.
You can, yes.
Okay. Now let's back up to the pilot's license. If I understand right, after you've been signed off to solo, so to speak, after the 6 to 10 hours of the gyroplane instruction, would you then be legal to fly this thing, or do you have to have the pilot's license before you are, quote, legal to fly it?
At that point in time, you're totally legal to fly that aircraft because you are a student pilot at that point. They've realized that to become a pilot, you have to fly solo. And as far as the regulations, you have to fly at least 20 hours of solo and log that before you can get your license. You also have to have 20 hours of dual instruction. So let's say you use the 8 or 10 of your hours up first, then you'll go keep going back to your instructor and get the other 10 over a period of time as you're building time solo. So it's a process. Then once you've got the 20 hours of single place and the 20 hours of dual logged in, then your instructor will sign you off for a check ride. Then it's time to go take the FAA written exam and actually have an examiner check you off for your actual pilot's license.
Okay. Now, all of this is foreign to me. I've not, this is an area outside of my expertise and general interest, but not that it's not interesting. It's very interesting to me. just not tackled this particular question before. So you were talking earlier about 6 to 10 hours of gyroplane instruction with an instructor who could then sign you off after doing what you call a two-plane or two-place, which is two people, him and you, in the craft together.
Yes.
After 6 to 10 hours of instruction, you are then able to fly on your own, which is at which point you start logging hours. And after 20 hours of dual and 20 hours of solo, you are then able to take an FAA written exam, which, of course, is going to require learning some FAA regulations. At which point in that process am I able to jump in my Super Sky Cycle and fly from point A to point B anywhere I want?
As soon as your instructor signs your student pilot's license, you're a student pilot at that point. You're totally legal to go fly. You just can't haul a passenger.
And you can't haul a passenger anyway in this thing.
This
so
is true.
That a, so basically,
this is exactly
6 to 10
right.
hours of gyroplane instruction, and you're good to go for point A to point B anywhere in the country.
That's exactly right. The only thing is, if you're in a traffic control area around a towered airport,
mm-hmm.
which is an area kind of like a upside-down wedding cake in the air,
mm-hmm.
the closer you get to that traffic area, you have to go lower and lower to stay out of that area because usually bigger aircraft are coming in and going in that area.
Mm-hmm.
If you get inside that traffic area, you have to talk to the tower. So while you're getting your 6 to 10 hours of instruction, your instructor is also teaching you how to talk to the tower and when to talk and what to say. That's part of your training.
Mm-hmm.
And he'll also tell you that if you're going to fly into a towered area, you'll have to have a transponder, which is a little device you can put on your aircraft. So you'd have to have a radio and a transponder to fly inside the aircraft air traffic control area.
Isn't
of that
the
airport.
Super Sky Cycle going to come equipped with that?
It can bolt in. We put just a basic model out, and then people can put the radio and the transponder at their leisure.
How much do those run?
The radio that I use is a little handheld, which I just strapped to my belt. It's about a $350 radio. It works real good. I have a real nice helmet that we spend a lot of money on. It's got noise canceling built in. You flip a little button, it gets really quiet, and you can hear everything really clear on the radio. And the transponders are about $1,000.
Okay. And the reason you don't equip that is because there's so many variables, and or is it for just bringing the price down a little more?
Well, most people that I know that have these gyroplanes like we do, we never even fly in an airport traffic area. I mean, I've never had a transponder on my vehicle. I don't want to go to DFW or even to Meacham Field. I go to the little airports, which is called Class G airspace. That's where I do most of my flying, and I can skirt around Fort Worth low enough. I never even get in a traffic area, so I don't even need one for what I do personally.
So the reason you don't equip it is because there's not too many people that will really need it, and if they need it, they can get it.
That's exactly right. I try to keep the price as low as I can. See, nearly half of the price of this kit is the engine. But the engine is so dependable and has a good reputation as being fuel efficient and has a 1,500-hour TBO like a regular airplane. That means before the engine has to be overhauled, it becomes a real vehicle, and you pay the money up front to get that engine, but you get a lot of service out of it.
Now, you use the word kit. This is not something that comes assembled. It comes in parts and you put it together?
Yes. The way the legal law is set up today, you can build a home-built motorcycle, and you get it registered at DMV, and you just prove that you bought the motor somewhere, it wasn't stolen. And a motorcycle in the USA has to have two or three wheels, brakes, lights, and mirrors. And you see a lot more tracks on the road these days, too. So the first thing you'll do is put your motorcycle part together and go get it licensed as your home-built motorcycle.
Uh-huh.
Then you finish the kit up as a 51% kit-built experimental aircraft. That's the legal law today that lets us build something like this. And so you build the second part and get it registered with an N number as an experimental aircraft. So in the existing laws today, you can own a fly-by-wire vehicle, but you have to build it.
Okay. And that's how you're able to get this thing out as a fly and drive piece of equipment is because, and to get in, to pass into the FAA regulations is because
yes.
it is a kit. It is basically an, is it considered an experimental?
It is.
Okay. And where do you see this going? Is this thing going to take off like hotcakes, or is it going to take, I mean, look how long it took for between the time of the Wright brothers and the time we were flying around in 747s.
Yes, here's what I look at. We live in the 21st century, and we're still landlocked.
Mm-hmm.
The normal person out here can't afford an airplane. He can't afford a helicopter, and he barely does afford his $30,000 vehicle he buys every 3 to 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
And here's another vehicle that's just a little more than that, but it will give the same service life that he had before and save him time. Time is the thing, and also get him off of that congested interstate that's getting more congested year by year. But starting with, because it is still open frame, we're calling it the Super Sky Cycle, the motorcycle people are the ones that's going to buy into this first. A lot of people have two or three Harleys sitting in the garage, and they're just going to want the flying motorcycle because they can have one.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, once we get the body finished, which we're working on that right now, that simply bolts on the same model, at that point we'll call it the commuter, and that's when it's going to take off to the general public.
Yeah, when you can fly in adverse weather conditions, warm, cold, raining, snowing, then it becomes more feasible as a reliable, dependable vehicle.
That is exactly right.
Now, what kind of,
we can fly in wind when airplanes and helicopters quit flying. The gyro is really, really stable in wind, so wind is not a problem. I live in Texas, and we have lots of wind here, and most of my testing that I test this thing is above 30 mile an hour wind on a hot, thermally gusty days.
Hmm.
So that is my normal test day.
What would be an upper limit of wind shearing and changing directions that you would not want to fly this thing in?
You never want to take any aircraft into that word wind shear. Basically, wind shear is where you have a big blast of air straight down, and you actually lose all your lift. I mean, that's deadly in about any aircraft. But as far as just winds, I mean, I've trained students on 42 mile an hour, quarter and crosswinds, gusty thermally days is normal for us.
Okay. When we talk about adding a body to this open frame, you're also talking about weight. What kind of loss in range and responsibility or respondability of the machine do you get with that?
Actually, it doesn't take away, it adds. Because the open frame is so draggy, there's a big drag coefficient. Lots
okay.
of drag. Almost every part of this aircraft is just hanging out. And then when you take that and put a real nice little aerodynamic body around the whole thing, its drag goes to one-fifth of what it was before.
Uh-huh.
So your speed increases, your gas mileage increases, and the body only weighs 30 pounds. See, our body's just a fairing. We don't have to have it for strength. Our frame is already there. So we can get by with a real light Kevlar body. And so actually your gas mileage, efficiency and speed and comfort, everything goes up when the body goes up.
Uh-huh. Now, talking about the price, we said this thing was about $37,000. That is just the Super Sky Cycle itself. That does not include shipping. The shipping is, of course, going to be quite expensive on this. What are we talking about on shipping on something?
Shipping on that model is about $900.
And is that fairly standard anywhere in the U.S.?
Yes.
Have you shipped outside the U.S.?
Yeah, we're getting set up to ship them around the world. We know that we've been getting an unbelievable response from the U.K. in the last 10 days.
Uh-huh.
There's been six newspaper and magazine people contact me and one TV station.
Uh-huh.
So there's just something about the U.K. that's taken off in the last 10 days. And, of course, we've already got dealer in Australia And we're going to ship kits, actually containers of kits, around the world. We're getting set up to do that.
I'm remembering now, trying to think where I saw your story. We covered it in our news about 2 weeks ago. It was a magazine or a television. Do you remember what that was?
It's probably Channel 8 over in Dallas came out and did a story on the SkyCycle a little over a year ago. Mm-hmm. And that story is still going around the world in emails where people are sharing it with their friends.
Uh-huh.
And it's on YouTube also. There's one YouTube of that Channel 8 deal. It's already got like 124,000 hits on it. And that's been the main one that's got the attention around the world, is Channel 8 News.
Internet's pretty incredible for getting the word out on things.
Yes, it is. The Internet is an amazing device.
I'm surprised you've only sold 5 in the year that these things have been available, though. I would have thought that it
would have been... Well, here's the thing. Even on the website, I haven't pushed the SkyCycle because there's a big chasm of having the prototype working and flying great and then putting that into production.
Uh-huh.
And so the new production model is actually a lot more streamlined. It's lighter weight. Let me tell you a little bit about that, matter of fact. Instead of having the big motorcycle front end on, like the prototype had,
mm-hmm.
it's got a front end that we make ourselves. It's chromed. And it's got the same size wheel in the front that it has in the back. So we have this real aerodynamic teardrop wheel pant that covers the whole front wheel brakes. It's got dual disc brakes in the front. So it looks space age in the front now, still looking just like a motorcycle.
Uh-huh.
The rear wheel pants are 5 feet long. They turn into fins in the back, and they got Cadillac tail lights that sticks out the back of each one. So we're adding a little bit of style along with function. So the next SkyCycle you see, that's the production model, is really a classy looking space age little vehicle.
When is that going to be available?
It's available right now.
Okay.
We're actually building 30 of the production models continually. We're continually building 30, the parts for 30.
Uh-huh. And how long does it take to build one?
It's going to take the average person about 200 hours from start to finish. It'll take you about 100 hours to do the motorcycle and 100 hours to finish up the flying part.
So that part of it is as long as people are having to build it themselves, that's going to be... is going to be a logjam in the getting this thing out to a lot of people. People just want to go to, you know, buy and drive type of thing.
Well, here's where I see it. Probably in 7-8 years from now, when the government, all it would take is the signature of a president on a piece of paper saying we're going to allow these fly drive vehicles to be mass produced and put on showroom floors.
Mm-hmm.
And if they will simply do that without having to go through that multi-million-dollar aircraft and motor vehicle stuff that has to happen with cars and airplanes, then we can build hundreds of thousands of these really easy because most of the parts are on CNC machine, and we can farm those out and build 300,000 next year if we need to. We can ramp up very, very fast. But it's going to take an act of Congress or a signature of the president to make it where we can put them on the showroom floor, which we'd be glad to do when they get ready for the fly-drive vehicle to really be a part of America and the world's transportation.
So once these pioneers who are buying these kits log enough hours and there's enough talk about their reliability and they become the wanted item, then you'll have enough data to be able to present to the Congress and say, here's how safe these things are, et cetera.
That's
what are
exactly.
you doing to log and to catalog, I should say, all the information that's coming in along those lines? Are you just being loose about that, or are you trying to keep close tabs of the hours flown and so you can get some safety data?
Well, we'll have data that comes in from our customers, this little high-tech device I told you about, this instrument. It also has a hops meter, so it gives you very accurate hours that this thing has been running. And here's the thing about an autogyro. The rotor on top isn't powered by the motor at all. It auto-rotates all the time as air passes up through it. So it's a real simple type of flying machine. It's just a flying, rotating wing. And you can shut the motor off on this, and come down slower than a parachute in total control, pick your spot to land, and land and not even roll 1 foot in our vehicles. So you don't drop out of the sky just because your motor quits, if it ever does. Number two, for those that want the added safety of a parachute, we have a gyro recovery system parachute. You pull a lever, and a big parachute comes out and lets the whole gyroplane down.
The parachute comes out from above the gyro, I imagine.
No, it comes out actually from below.
And how come it doesn't get tangled in the gyro?
That's the good part. If you ever need that parachute, something's already happened to your rotor or the control system already, or you would normally fly it down and land, you know, under control.
Uh-huh.
But if anything catastrophic like hitting another aircraft in the air disrupts your flight, you're not coming down right side up anymore. You're coming down inverted, upside down, nose down. The tail will be the last thing flying if you ever need that parachute. So under that scenario, the parachute is shooting straight up, and we have a little latch that's hooked on the right landing gear. The Kevlar strap to the parachute goes through that latch first. So initially, the parachute is hooked to the bottom of the gyro. So the rotor always rotates away from the parachute, number one. Then once the pilot sees that the rotor is stopped and no longer a threat to his parachute, you pull a second lever, which releases the latch, and the Kevlar strap is actually hooked above your head at the rotor. And so if the thing, gravity makes it flip back right side up, and your G-force landing gear will take even the landing on impact when it does hit the ground.
So the parachute, there are safety measures to keep that from deploying until that last resort scenario?
Yes, it's a red lever, and actually on the ground you got a little pin that goes in it that makes it where you can't pull the lever out.
Uh-huh.
And that lever has to be pulled with about 5 pounds of pressure. If you just lightly pull it, it won't work. And you have to purposely give it a good little jerk. So it sets in its holder with a little snap deal where it doesn't, you know, it definitely won't deploy unless you pull the lever.
Uh-huh. Tell us about this autogyro. I've never heard of that before. That sounds fascinating.
Okay, the autogyro was actually designed by Mr. Sierva back in the 1920s. And the reason he wanted to make a rotating wing is so that you would have an aircraft that would not stall. Now let's talk what stall means. If you take a regular airplane that's flying along on fixed wings, if you get to a certain slow speed, the wings themselves will stall and the aircraft will literally spiral out of flight. It's called a stall, and it will go in two or three revolutions before you can get it back out. It takes a little time to get out of the stall and get those wings flying again.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Sierra knew that if you could have rotating wings over your head, there would be no stall at all. You actually could stop and auto-rotate straight down even without your wings stalling, so a gyroplane won't stall.
Those little toys that you have that you pull a little string in this little horizontally rotating gyro type of thing goes flying up in the air, and then it, or like those, what are those things that they're pods that come out of trees, and they're like little helicopters.
Sycamore seed. That sycamore seed is auto-rotation. It's the same principle.
Okay. So that sycamore seed is the same principle as this autogyro, so that as you lose all power, your engine fails, is not turning anymore, the autogyro comes into effect, and you gradually come down to the ground like that little sycamore seed. And how fast are you, when you hit the ground, how fast are you going?
Okay, let's take our vehicle. We're flying over 70 miles an hour. We reach over and pull the throttle all the way back and just turn the motor off.
Mm-hmm.
All it does is slow up from 70 to 40, and you just hold the stick exactly where it was when you're flying, and it will keep 40 mile an hour in about a 45 degree angle toward the ground. You fly that down all the way to the ground at 40 mile an hour, down to about 10 feet above the ground. Then when you pull back on the stick, you change the tilt of the whole wing, and it immediately sees a bigger area because the rotor is tilting back in relation from the, if you're sitting in a seat, the front of the rotor goes up and the back of the rotor goes down. So when it sees more air, it speeds up. It speeds up in what we call a flare. The flare will give you about 3 seconds of pure hover. So you can touch the ground feather soft with the motor out any time in an autogyro. You fly it down to the ground, you flare, you go into that pure hover for about 3 seconds and later gently sit down with no roll.
So there's in this catastrophic, well, that's not necessarily catastrophic failure. The engine turns off scenario. However high you are, you're going to have to be conscious to be able to once you get 10 feet above the ground, make that change in the tilt and to then come down really gently. If you're unconscious, then you're going to be hitting the ground at 40 miles an hour.
That's true. No, that's not 40 mile an hour straight down. That's 40 mile an hour forward flight speed.
Okay.
Which is very,
Well, let's talk about an unconscious scenario. Let's say a pilot passes out for one reason or another. Bird crashes into his helmet or whatever. He's diabetic and he goes low and he doesn't have any insulin or doesn't have any glucose and he passes out. And the plane is flying along 7 miles an hour. The pilot goes unconscious. What happens?
Well, that would be anybody's guess at that point. I mean, he's going to hit something. He can't flare, so, that wouldn't be an ideal situation to be in. If I thought I was passing out, I think I would just reach and pull the parachute and then let it do its thing. I'd rather come down upside down under a parachute than to just fly into the ground.
So in an unconscious, if you felt yourself going unconscious, then you would, rather than go for the sycamore seed scenario and just come down that way through autogyro, you're going to want to come down with parachute.
That's what I would do. If I thought I was going unconscious, I would just simply shut the motor off and pop the chute. That's exactly what I'd do.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to come down at least under a parachute straight down and have a chance of living. But if you're flying along, you're not controlling the rotor at all, you might put it into a left bank or a front bank or a nose down bank. No telling what you're going to do if you're going unconscious. So I'd rather just pop the chute and come down under a parachute.
Okay. So let's, I know there's a million different scenarios, but let's just play this one more scenario.
Okay.
The engine fails and the pilot is unconscious. What's
okay.
going to happen?
Well, he's going to crash. I don't know hardly any aircraft that you can just go dead or unconscious in the seat and walk away.
Yeah.
I mean, you've got to control that rotor. Sure, it's a nice big parachute and you can flare and do all this stuff, but if you're not flaring and no telling what you're going to do to the stick when you go unconscious, you might push it far forward or you might jerk it completely straight back.
Mm-hmm.
This thing, like I say, we have tested, and it's on the website of videos of us actually doing testing with our landing gear. We flared the height of a light pole and auto-rotated to the ground without hurting anything and take right back off. I mean, it's unbelievable what the landing gear will absorb, but, you have to be in an attitude where it's designed, to work, which is going straight forward and the nose about 10 degrees up. If you can pull the nose about 10 degrees up, which is a normal flare landing, and keep straight with the direction that you're going, that landing gear will absorb tremendous amounts of energy.
Does the training require you to stall the engine?
Yes, training will work in to power outs, which, in training we normally just throttle all the way back, which is the same as powered out. You're not getting any thrust.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually a little more drag because the propeller spinning is more drag than it would be if it was stopped. But it's the same scenario. When you take the throttle out, you lose your thrust, then it's the same as it would be if the motor was turned off. And that is part of your training, and most of the landings I do is throttle all the way back. It's what's fun. You test your skills on your flare and your spot that you land throttle back every time is probably it's one of the most fun things to do in the gyro is to land.
Let's talk about some day-to-day or type of scenarios where commuting, I want to go from point A to point B, I live in a suburban neighborhood, and I live in the, I work in the city, and I'm coming home from work, and I haven't gotten yet to my field where I'm able to take off because I'm in a high-rise scenario. Well, let's high-rise scenario. I guess you could just land on the roof, park on the roof. Is that possible?
If they would allow you to, sure.
Mm-hmm. If you have a helipad on the top of your high-rise, then you could land there and park your vehicle off on the corner of the high-rise, no?
Yes, if they would allow you to, you certainly could do that.
Mm-hmm. So you're driving in traffic, and you have some congestion. You want to get out of there. How legally, what kind of scenario are you required to have before you can turn on those props and fly out of the city?
Okay, what we do is we don't just haphazardly just pick a spot to take off. Let's keep this as legal as we can. Know where all the little airports are. There's lots of airports scattered everywhere. Or, here's what I envision to happen. The little field next to my house, I'm going to turn into a TOLA. I bought the website, TOALAS.com, TOLAS.com. That's takeoff and landing areas. And I think farmers will have them, Walmarts will have them, restaurants will have them. The people at the interstate intersections will have a TOLA next to their gas station. They'll pave a little area before and after a exit, maybe 300 feet long between the run between the highways as a TOLA next to each exit. I think that would be an excellent, simple way to do TOLAs. But you've got these legally marked TOLAs that has a GPS coordinate. You simply drive to the nearest TOLA. You put a dollar in the box when you drive in. You put a dollar in the box when you leave out. So you're paying a dollar use fee for takeoff and a dollar use fee for landing. That pays people to keep the thing mowed and keep it presentable as a takeoff and landing area. You drive to the nearest TOLA that is marked, and everyone knows that it is a TOLA. You fold your rotor out, and you take off from a TOLA. You might have to drive 3 miles. You might have to drive five. Then you fly the 50 to 75 miles out of all that traffic and land the closest TOLA to your house. Then fold it up and put it in the garage.
So you don't have to necessarily go to an airport, but right now, legally, you need to go to either an airport or a TOLA.
Now, well, any landowner that gives you permission to use their field can legally be used to take off and land. That's the right that we have as Americans, is that we can allow or use our property the way we see fit.
What about a county road, a dirt road?
A county road would not be a good thing to do because you're not supposed to be landing and taking off on county roads. Farmers' fields are fine. We don't have to have that smoothness of the road because we don't roll that far to take off. We certainly don't have to have it to land because we don't even roll when we touch.
I would
frown on county roads, but yes, a lot of people will be doing it. They'll look right, they'll look left, they say nobody's around, they're going to swoop in, land, fold it up, start driving. I know they're going to do it, but I'm not telling them to.
Okay. And in terms of taking off, do we need to have any vertical motion before takeoff, or can we take off from a helicopter straight up?
Our models never take off straight up. It starts flying at 25 miles an hour. We bring the rotors to full flying speed, sitting still and holding the brakes. Once we release the brakes, we leave the ground in 3 to 5 seconds. So if you have a 15 mile an hour headwind, in other words, the wind's blowing into your face 15 mile an hour, you only have to gain 10 mile an hour roll on the ground for it to lift off.
Mm-hmm.
But at zero airspeed, we're leaving the ground in under 150 feet consecutively. So if you've got wind, it's less than 150 feet.
Okay. Well, it's been a fascinating interview. It's been a lot of fun. We do need to wrap it up. Your website?
It's www.thebutterflyllc.com. Thebutterflyllc.com.
Great. And we have been speaking with Larry. What's your last name again?
Neal, N-E-A-L.
Larry Neal, you're the inventor of this?
Yes.
And you have patents on this or just pending?
I do. I have a patent on it called a fly drive vehicle.
Fly/drive vehicle.
Yes.
Fascinating. Thank you for your time. You've been listening to Free Energy Now. I'm your host, Sterling Allen. You can join us every day at freeenergynews.com. See our upcoming shows for this Saturday weekly segment at freeenergynow.net. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Really enjoyed it.